Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. My name's David Clegg. I'm here in place of Paul Malik, who's otherwise engaged on this election week, and I am joined by two very special guests. I'm very excited by what we've got for you today. I have Kezia Dugdale, the director of the John Smith Centre at the University of Glasgow, and Chris Dearen, the director of Reform Scotland. Two vast intellects, two very important people in Scottish public life. And Kezia Dugdale's here as well. I jest, of course. Thank you so much for joining us. I should say that as well as those esteemed titles, Kezia is a columnist for The Courier and Chris is a columnist for the P&J. So you can read their thoughts in our newspapers every week as well. It is voting day as we record this. People have gone to the polls. It's going to be a strange experience. There's not an overnight count. So you will be listening to this, I guess, as the results start to trickle in on Friday and Saturday. So we thought it was a very good opportunity to pause for a little bit and reflect on the election campaign and Scottish politics more widely. So let's start with you, Chris, because you are making your debut on this Stooshy. You haven't been on the podcast before, but you do have podcast experience in another one of your roles. How many jobs do you have, Chris? So you're the director of Reform Scotland, you're a P&J columnist, you're a rock star, which we'll maybe talk about a little bit later, and you're also the Scotland editor of New Statesman. Do you sleep at all, or how do you?
I also review books for The Big Issue, which is actually my favourite job of all because I get free books out of that. But I hadn't listened to a podcast or taken part in a podcast until 4 weeks ago when the New Statesman asked me if I'd do a Scottish election special. And so it's been a bit of a baptism of fire. I'll leave it to others to decide whether it worked or not. But they're good fun, aren't they? It's not like a radio show. It's quite free-flowing. And yeah, it's like sitting in a pub with mates just without the beer.
Also, we have Chris Finn, producer, here. So if you swear or say anything silly, the beauty of it is that he can fix it for you afterwards and we don't need to worry about the concerns of live radio. Now, the New Statesman podcast was a dirty word in this house recently because we were discussing last week how one of the New Statesman podcasts pepped us to the post in the Publishers Podcast Awards. But to show that we don't bear grudges, we thought we'd invite you on this week. And so it is great to have you here, Chris. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I would say that the New Statesman's success has nothing to do with me.
I think we can all tell that. let's ask your general thoughts on the election to begin with. You've been watching Scottish politics for a while. Can I check? You were political editor of the Daily Record at one stage as well, weren't you?
Long time ago, yeah, about 20 years ago. For a very brief period.
Did you cover any Holyrood campaign for the Record?
It was before that. So I think I covered the referendum. It'd been 97, whenever the referendum was.
You don't look old enough.
I know, but I've got good genes. No, it was Make Mine a Double Dure. So that was the front page, and it had Donald Dure with a whiskey. Uh-huh. God, it feels such a long time ago now, doesn't it?
It is quite a long time ago, to be fair.
Well, that's true. 5 minutes ago, but 20 years. So I was never really a red top guy.
I was still at school, just drop that in there.
I was still at school too as well. And not in Scotland, it has to be said.
Right, but you both look so much older.
Okay. Oh, he's good, isn't he?
Yeah, well, as we've got Kez here as well, Kez is well known to our listeners. You've been on a couple of times before. Thank you for joining us again. Who wants to go first? It has been a very strange campaign. Now, I feel like this campaign hasn't really caught fire. Has that been because of COVID? Has that been because the result is a foregone conclusion and everyone knows who's going to be First Minister next week? Chris, what's your general thoughts on it been?
Well, for me, the overriding feeling about this election is that it's been pretty much set in stone since the start. And by that, I don't just mean that the SNP are going to win it in one way or another, but actually pretty much all the parties, maybe other than the Greens, have shown almost no movement in their polling figures at all. So you've got the Tories and Labour fighting out for second place, and some weeks Labour are up a couple of points, some weeks the Tories are up a couple of points and the other side's down. You've got the SNP, you know, still just rubbing along 20 points ahead of the others. And it looks like the Greens, I think, will come out maybe doubling their seats or whatever, which would be a big result for them. So it's been, the causes of that, I think undoubtedly COVID has played its part because it's frozen politics as usual. So we've not come into the election with the full hurricane that we get usually, with the parties knocking lumps out of each other. It's been interesting that there hasn't really been a lot of criticism of Sturgeon, for example, about handling of COVID. So that's removed one of the key targets that the opposition parties might have had. And obviously we've got two quite new leaders as well, in Anas Sarwar for Labour and Douglas Ross for the Conservatives. So there's been a degree of unknown with them, yeah. Sort of suck it and see for the voters to make their minds up. So it's been a very strange election. I thought, you know, if you'd looked at the polls 6 months ago, it felt like the SNP were building up momentum to an overall majority. You know, they're way ahead in terms of votes for independence as well, 55%, 58%. But that's all seems to have settled down a bit now. And there's even the possibility the Nats could lose a couple of seats, yeah. I think, if you look at some of the polls. So, you know, much as it was, I guess the key question is, do the SNP get that majority? Or is it another minority government, which means that Nicola Sturgeon wouldn't necessarily have the latitude she'd like to drive the next 5 years.
Kezia, what's your reflections? 5 years ago, you were the Scottish Labour leader coming into the last Holyrood election campaign. This one's felt very different from then. What have you felt about it as a spectator?
Yeah, 5 years ago, I would be touring the country in a car right now, trying to see as many last minute candidates as I could before having a cheeky afternoon nap so I could stay up all night and watch the results. Now I'm sat in my partner's house in Mark Inch, and the living room is full of SNP billboards and leaflets. So it's been a bit of a journey, really, hasn't it? I've always loved elections. I wrote in my Courier column this week that, you know, my most kind of stark memory of elections was in 1992, staying up or begging my dad to stay up all night and watching the Scottish results coming in and colouring in this chart with my wee pens about who was winning what. So the art of elections, the political theatre of elections, is something I just kind of live for. So I'm really excited to be a spectator on this one. I agree with Chris's analysis entirely. We're in an odd position where the two final opinion polls going into polling day, one of them has the SNP on 59 seats, which would see a reduction. Yeah. It would be their kind of worst result since 2007. But when we say worst result, we're still talking about them getting more seats than any other party has in the history of devolution. So you've got to put that into a bit of context. And then the other poll has them on 68, which would give them a majority without the Greens or any other party for a second independence referendum. Which one do you believe? Where do you go? I mean, the polls are a mess. There's going to be no exit poll. There's going to be no sampling from counts. I'm thoroughly looking forward to watching pundits kind of pass the hours saying nothing or saying lots rooted in nothing for days, because we're not really going to know the lie of the land until Saturday afternoon.
Well, I had one broadcaster in Northern Ireland call me and say, can you come in and talk about some of the results at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning? I'm like, no, I can't, sorry, because there'll be nothing to say.
It's the Sunday newspaper columnists I feel for, because they're going to have to file their copy on Saturday, you know, with the election still dribbling in towards the end of the afternoon.
What do you make of that, Chris, about the... there's just this... I think there's been this sense where... Kez makes an interesting point, which is that I think that the election hasn't really captured the public imagination, particularly because people don't think that there's going to be any difference, that things will just continue as normal. We'll have Nicola Sturgeon as First Minister again, and there's an element of, God, there's so much else going on. I'm more interested in coronavirus and the loosening restrictions or whatever else, and actually this election is going to make a great deal of difference. Actually, it could make a great deal of difference, because there is a significant... there's a substantial change to what Nicola Sturgeon is going to be pursuing if she has 59 seats and if she has 69 seats in regards to a second referendum and everything else.
It's obviously a huge election, and not just for Scotland, but for the UK, given some of the issues that are at stake. I think one of the things that interests me is that, you know, Nicola Sturgeon has been in the cabinet since 2007, a senior member of the cabinet since 2007. Most of the cabinet, I feel, has been in the cabinet since 2007. You know, their faces are so well known to the voters. Everyone made their minds up about them as individuals a long time ago. And so they're just, you know, you get that sense that voters tend to get bored with politicians. Remember Brian Wilson, the MP, used to say that you had something like 10 years in the public eye and then people had enough of you and you'd get packed off. And that hasn't happened to the SNP. And it's still largely populated on the front bench by you know, the people that were there when they were still a minority, and, you know, they were working from a little room in Edinburgh above a pawn shop. And those guys are still very much in the front line. So I think that, you know, the makeup of the party isn't particularly exciting beyond Sturgeon and maybe someone like Kate Forbes, who's talented and coming through. So, you know, I think voters are looking at that and thinking, well, where am I supposed to get excited here? The real excitement, of course, is in, do they get the overall majority? And then are we going to have a big battle with Westminster over whether there should be an independence referendum? But, you know, there'll be other voters who are looking at the SNP government's record on education and on health and on the economy. And, you know, there's plenty to pick apart in that. And so not everyone's voting about the constitution. I think a lot of people, parents, for example, voting about the state of their kid's school, maybe voting on, if you've got elderly parents or parents in a care home, they might be voting on that, how that went in the last year. And I think that's where people start to look at the other parties, maybe on the second votes, okay, and whatever. And for me, the really interesting thing here is what Labour does in this election. I don't think they're going to grab loads more seats than they had, but I can't wait to see their share of the vote across the UK and whether Anas has managed to introduce a degree of excitement and personal interest in him, because he's clearly got a bit of flair about him. And for me, that's kind of the new bit of this election. Sure. It's probably not relevant particularly until the next election, when Anas will be more in place.
I'd be interested in your thoughts on that, Kez. Something that Chris said struck me, and get your thoughts on that, because in the media class, we talk a lot about the SNP's record in government, and there is, whatever your view, there is very credible arguments to be made about they haven't met their ambitions on education, on health, on all these issues that we normally think are bread and butter issues. But also the handling of the coronavirus pandemic, I think, is really interesting, because Nicola Sturgeon's personal popularity has improved during that period. We saw the figures for independence go up during that period, and we thought there was a correlation there that, you know, Sturgeon's handling coronavirus better than Boris, so maybe independence looks better. But in this election campaign, there's not the opposition parties have barely even really tried to scrutinize their record on coronavirus. They've made more efforts in education and health, I guess, but Labour are that party who try to change the conversation to be about things that are not the constitution. You must have found that frustrating. How are they getting on with convincing Scotland to think about something other than the constitution?
Like, I tried to do this in 2016 as well, in part because I think it's the right thing to do, to move on from the constitutional debate, or at least to have a broader debate. But you can't take the voter somewhere they don't want to go, right? So the evidence is very clear that in Scotland, certainly, the number one thing defining how people are voting today is a position on the constitution in 2014. So in any other election, the economy polls as the top issue. Now, obviously, there's a correlation between the constitution, the economy, and how people think, but the constitution is still dominating the debate. And that makes it very, very difficult to make the story of the day anything other than that. And that's why, you know, 6 months ago, when we were all speculating about whether or not this election would take place today, you had the SNP really quite keen for it to take place in May, because they knew it would be framed around the constitution, but also COVID and Nicola's handling, and knew that her personality ratings would really guide them really far through that, just as it's working for Mark Drakeford in Wales. And what's happening in Wales, I think, is really interesting to contrast as well.
You mentioned that in your column this morning, and I hadn't really spotted that little element of the polling, that Labour are flying, but also independence is flying in Wales through the COVID pandemic.
Yes, and you can learn more about this on my podcast, because like Chris, I've got to shoehorn that in there. So we've got a University of Glasgow podcast called Spotlight, and we explored this with Professor Nicola McEwen yesterday, and that will be available on ufgspotlight.com later this afternoon, actually. But what we explored there is, you've got a situation in Wales where Mark Drakeford, like Nicola Sturgeon, has soaring personality ratings, doing really well. Labour are somewhere between 9 and 11% points ahead of the Conservatives in Wales, despite Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak being in Wales, I think, three times in the last 3 weeks. But at the same time, you've seen a rapid rise in support for Welsh independence, which has gone from around about the 3% mark in 2014, actually, when we were debating independence in Scotland, as high as 28 to 30% today in some of the Welsh polls. But intriguingly, Labour support high, Mark Drakeford high, Plaid Cymru nowhere. So this rise of Welsh independence isn't being matched in the way it has done in Scotland with a rising support for the SNP. And the conclusions that you can draw from that are suddenly people in Wales are waking up to the idea of a Welsh Parliament, mm-hmm. it having significant powers, its own trajectory of leadership, and people like that in Wales, and they're looking for more of it. If I can just make one cheeky other geeky point about turnout, which I think is worth exploring today, that there are three potential scenarios, I think, coming out of what the number of people that vote in Scotland today. If it's high, if it's 55%, I think the SNP are on for a majority, and then the debate for Indy Ref 2 spirals from there. Mm-hmm. There's a chance, though, it's going to be low. It could be around the 50% mark. And those people that stay at home, in my experience, in my view, are largely soft SNP voters. They're young families in Barrett homes, in suburban council estates, who are having that conversation over tea time tonight, will we bother, will we not? If it's 50%, that hurts the SNP, and the Unionist parties benefit from that in a lot of other parts of the country. But here's the twist. I think it's possible that the turnout could drop below 50%. And imagine a scenario where it's below 50%, and that happened once in 2003, but the SNP still somehow managed to get a majority. Mm-hmm. How the UK government responds to that in terms of saying, well, you did get a majority, but less than half the country voted, I think it'll be very interesting to see what that does to the wider debate in Scotland.
There's another aspect to that, Kes, which is that if I was the UK government and I was watching this election and the SNP get back in as a minority government with roughly the same number of seats that they had in 2016, I would say, well, where is the evidence that Brexit has actually stimulated a complete change in the view of the Scottish people that they want a referendum? Nobody's voting for you any more than they were before. They might dislike Brexit, but actually, when you look at the figures, you're stuck. You're not on the up. There is no groundswell of opinion towards independence, and therefore we don't think that you've got the right to a referendum.
Yeah, that's a fair one, actually. But what's interesting about it is that there is movement within who those SNP voters are. So we've got polling evidence which shows us that in 2016 and in previous Scottish Parliament elections, there was actually a sizable chunk of people who voted SNP despite independence, that didn't want independence. They just liked their competency and what they were doing around policy. That's disappeared. That's gone through the floor now because of that binary nature of yes or no defining how people vote. The people who don't want independence are not voting SNP today. But what has happened is the SNP has gained a huge number of voters from largely Labour, actually, because of Brexit. So there has been a Brexit bounce. It's just been offset by those people who don't want independence that voted for that old message of team record and vision that you saw from Nicola and Alex Salmond moving on.
Another notable part of the campaign for me has been that Brexit hasn't figured particularly heavily in the public debate either, Chris.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I suppose the consequence of Brexit, the really interesting thing in a Scottish political perspective is the impact that it has on support for independence. And it took a while after Brexit. You know, we all looked for that bounce for the SNP and independence in the months after the Brexit vote, and it didn't really happen. But then a year or so on, you started to see it. That, you know, that's when we're talking about the polls rising up to, you know, mid-50s in favour of independence, and the SNP really soaring in the polls. But I think the problem the SNP have is that the movement to them from no voters in 2014 and maybe who voted Remain and Brexit is very, very soft. So if the poll's asking someone, are you going to vote for independence, and they're considering it, they'll probably say yes to a direct question. That doesn't mean that come the referendum, they are going to vote yes. And so, you know, we've seen that the support for independence, support for the SNP has dropped again as we've approached the election. We know that, you know, when the Unionist side gets going on this and starts to make the arguments about currency and your mortgage and your pension and trading with England, all of those kind of things, that, you know, that's going to put more doubt into people's minds when they're actually faced with the big decision. So, you know, I think in a way Brexit is still to play out in the Scottish political scene. I don't think we've seen the full consequences yet until we have a referendum, probably.
So whenever you were trying to change the conversation away from the constitution as Scottish Labour leader in 2016, Kes, it was 18 months since the election or something like that, 20 months. So it was very, very fresh. We're a full 5 years on from that now, and it doesn't feel like it's receding in any way. And it also feels like all those other issues we're discussing are not going to get particular care and attention until this issue is resolved. Is there an argument for Labour that biting the bullet and having a second referendum and seeing how it washes up is the only way that they can recalibrate politics to
something that's more in tune with how they view the world.
So there's obviously an argument for it, and there's some quite prominent high-profile Labour people making that exact case. And in fact, many rest of UK Labour politicians think that's the obvious logical answer, which is why they put their foot through the bucket whenever they come up to Scotland and start talking about it. It's not going to happen, though. And the reason it's not going to happen is that you have to remember that as Labour's percentage share of the vote in Scotland has fallen and fallen consistently over, well, you know, 5, 10 and 20 years in the past, every time people leave voting Labour as a habit, it concentrates the unionism of what's left behind. So what you actually have is a party which is very, very staunchly against independence. So to be advocating for a second independence referendum in order to kind of clean up the party sits very, very uncomfortably with a lot of people within it. You know, you've Neil Findlay is a great example of somebody who is very pragmatic and says, look, this is what the people want. This is what people in my working class community in West Lothian want. We can't ever talk about the kind of class politics that I want to talk about until this is gone. But then, you know, Anas is the leader, and Anas is a very staunch unionist. Mm-hmm. He's very clear in his opposition to independence and is very authentic in that, and he just won't countenance it.
He's also someone, though, who's quite pragmatic and understands that you need power to execute any of your agenda. So, for example, you know, if we look at the polling here, Anas Sarwar, by almost universal feeling amongst the commentariat, anyway, has ran, you know, perhaps the best campaign of anyone. His personal ratings have improved. The public seems to feel pretty warm towards him. He's clearly a very talented communicator. He's very good on television. He has a natural rapport with the public, as we saw in that video where he's dancing with the dance group in Glasgow.
And he's a lovely guy. He's a genuinely lovely guy.
The Labour vote share has gone down during that time, whenever personal popularity as leader has been improving. And what that tells me, if I was looking at it, is that people like Labour. They like the Labour leader now. I mean, there was a lot of anger towards Labour whenever you were trying to lead the party. Now that that anger has dissipated, they have a leader who the public quite likes. But as they get closer to election day, the mind is again being focused on the constitution, and in that argument, unions just going to move towards the Tories because the Tories are the unionist party.
I'm not sure what your evidence base is for the anger has left. I think there still is a lot of anger connected to the referendum. And, you know, I think Anas has done a brilliant job throughout this campaign, without question.
Well, I'll give an
but I also, hang on, mm-hmm. I think it's amusing that he's kind of presented as some sort of political ingenue. He's not, you know, he's a very experienced politician. He was the leader of the No campaign in the 2014 referendum. He's done TV debates before. He's a well-kent face in that regard. But the reason the polls show Labour support going down is because it's a binary choice, and the no vote is coalescing behind the Conservatives. And the reason I'm afraid to say I think the Conservatives will hold on to second and probably hold on to it quite well is the extent of their digital spend in this election, which is going very, very heavily. They're spending more on digital than I think all the other parties combined. That was a Times story that said that. And that is, like, you know, laser focus on a particular demographic of voters who are saying, you know, forget every other aspect of this election, Boris Johnson, Douglas Ross, all the rest of it. If you want to stop independence, you have to vote for this. And that, I think, will work for them.
Chris, what's your view on that? What's Labour's best hope for getting themselves out of this two-decade hole in the making?
Well, I interviewed Nicola Sturgeon last week, and I asked her about Anas Sarwar, and she was very, very complimentary about him, said she rated him very highly, thought he was very capable, but she wasn't sure he would be able to continue to sit on the fence for very much longer on the constitution. But my instinct is actually that he can. I don't think there's any rush for Labour to declare itself one way or the other. We're voting today, so that's done. Mm-hmm. The result will be what the result is. And I think in a way Labour can wait and get the results on Saturday, look at what the SNP have achieved or not achieved, look at the makeup of Parliament. There's probably time then to wait and see what the response is from Boris Johnson. If there is clearly massive Scottish appetite for an independence referendum within the next 2.5 years, it might well be that Labour say, okay, let's have it, and then try to win it for the no side. I don't think there will be a referendum in the next couple of years. I think there's a good chance there won't be one in this parliament, or if there is, it'll certainly be towards the end of the parliament. And in which case, that sort of gives Anas time to carry on talking about schools and talking about mental health and talking about welfare and these kind of things. And you know, at some point, people are going to have to address this stuff. You know, our schools are not in the shape that they should be. Neither is our NHS. Our economy has all sorts of challenges coming down the line, and challenges that are here already. And I just think it's worth an experiment for a little bit longer to do what Anas is doing, and almost to sit on the fence with the Constitution. He said that they're not in favour of independence. He doesn't want an independence referendum. And I think you can stick with that and say, why the hell are we not talking about education? Why are we not talking about the economy? And just let it breathe for a little bit longer and see. We'll see what the result is. You know, we'll see if the Labour share of the vote's gone up or not. I don't think Douglas Ross has had a good campaign, but I think Kez might be right that just that focus on yes or no, and if you're yes to independence, you go SNP. If you're no, you go to the Tories. But, you know, give them a little bit longer, allow the charm to come through, more FMQs, more time on the television, and maybe in a year or two we'll see that he does have the ability to change the conversation. Maybe not, but I just feel it's worth a bit more time.
Let's talk about a bit more about Douglas Ross. You mentioned him there, because that is the kind of the irony of this, is that I think the general view is that Anas Sarwar's had a good campaign and Douglas Ross has had a bad campaign, yet the Tories seem to be polling ahead of Labour. What have you thought of Douglas Ross in this campaign, Kez?
He's had a difficult time. There's no doubt about that. But he's probably been unfairly presented because of the boots that he's filling. So, you know, he was never going to be Ruth Davidson. There's for so many different reasons, he's just not the communicator that she is. That always sounds critical of Douglas Ross in an unfair way, but we forget that Ruth was a broadcaster. She was a trained communicator. She knew how to connect with people. So it's not really a fair comparison. But he's also not as easy in his skin as she was, as relaxed in kind of people's company or in front of the cameras, doing outlandish photo calls, of which we've not had anywhere near as many in this campaign as we did in 2016. And again, he is a politician at a time of global populism where we prefer populist leaders. And that's what Boris Johnson is. He's a populist leader. And as a consequence of being a populist leader, he's allowed to be a sort of caricature and to say and do outlandish things. Douglas Ross is very formal football referee. He's, you know, suit and tied all the time. It doesn't look right not in a suit or tie. He's almost like a politician of a different time and age. And this is going to probably end up being presented as some sort of massive defence of Douglas Ross, which I am not predisposed to making, but I'm just trying to offer a little bit of kind of broader context about how he's being perceived in this particular political time.
The other thing I suppose it's worth mentioning is, because, you know, that view of Ruth Davidson is very widely held, but he's only been in the job for a few months, as Chris pointed out at the start. And I can very clearly remember being at a Tory conference in Troon in March 2013, I think. And the whole conservative vibe then was they were all briefing against her. There was a moment there when they nearly took her out as leader. And she, you know, so she had a very slow start as well. So we do, and obviously Anas Sarwar, while not inexperienced, as you point out, he's new to the leadership position as well.
But there is something that leaders today, I think, and there are good examples of this in Scotland, need, which is a capacity for growth once they're in office or once they take over the leadership. I think you had it, Kez. Ruth Davidson grew into that role. She was a bit lucky because the independence campaign came along and she was thrust in. It suited her skill set. But Anas has grown as well as a politician, as he keeps saying. You know, he's not the politician he was 10 years ago. And Nicola Sturgeon is a completely different politician to the one she was 20 years ago. Yeah. But they've kind of grown into themselves. They haven't pretended, you know, started off as themselves and then grown into some character, Alvin Stardust sort of thing. That they've actually grown into being much more like they are as people. So as Kez says, they're comfortable in their own skin. They come across as being entirely natural when you're talking to them. The thing about Douglas Ross is, actually, when you speak to him away from the public eye, he is funny and smart and moderate and thoughtful. And he's got a big picture of him meeting Lionel Messi on his wall, you know, which is, I think, a lovely boyish thing to have. I'd have that if I'd ever met Lionel Messi. But as soon as you turn the camera on, it's the, you know, the tie's pulled up to the point you think his head's going to pop off his shoulders, and he's got lines to take, and he sticks to them, and he just keeps banging on about no independence referendum. And, you know, it's, again, Ruth was better at it. It just feels like the Tories have gone on, for me anyway, it's been too long with his one-note campaign, and I don't think Douglas has Ruth's ability to sell that either. So again, they might do perfectly well in this election, but I don't think it's really down to Douglas. It's just down to probably the remnants of that unionist coming together.
On that point on Douglas Ross on camera, just for listeners, I'll point out that I did interviews with the party leaders, and at the same time, Jim Smith, the farmer comedian, did an on the farm interview with them, and Douglas Ross, I think, performed best in that. He was pretty funny. Possibly because he went to agricultural college and he was very much in the right environment.
Speaks the language
for him
of hectares.
To do. Yeah, he was in his media, maybe. But let's move on to the two parties we haven't discussed. The independence parties looking for votes on the list. We'll start with the Greens and then move on. Chris, you said at the start there that you thought the Greens could be the party that makes some significant progress this election. Why do you think that is? I guess the polling evidence suggests it as one reason, but why do you think that it looks like they could advance?
Well, I think it's going to happen because the New Statesman's polling guy told me that they would probably go from 5 seats to 10 seats, possibly 9, possibly 11. So I've now adopted that as my view.
always listen to experts.
That's right. And then claim it as your own. You know, I think Patrick Harvey is an impressive performer. The Green politics are not mine. The Green Party's politics are not mine. I think they're far too extreme and actually get in the way of achieving a lot of the things that they want to. But, you know, when you watch Patrick Harvey in those debates, he's able, he's quite funny, very much holds his own against the rest of them. And the thing is, of course, now that they've been supporting the SNP government through the last term, they've won some, you know, wrangled some policy wins out of that. Mm-hmm. If they get 10 seats this time, and if the SNP fall back a little bit, I don't know, there may be the possibility of a formal coalition of the Greens getting maybe some jobs in government, mm-hmm. or whatever. They might not want to do that in Nicola Sturgeon, but you know, we've got COP26 this year. We've got, you know, a push for a referendum, and she might feel it makes sense in a way to somehow formally organise the yes side in ways that knit them more tightly together.
Yeah.
And certainly the Greens will be able to demand more from the SNP, either as a one of the opposition parties or in a coalition with 10 MSPs than they would with 5. So I feel this could be quite transformative for them. The great regret, of course, is that they've lost Andy Whiteman, yeah. who I think was the most free-thinking yeah. and impactful of them on a way. And the fact that he's gone, I think, says a lot about where the Greens are and some of the views that they hold.
What have you made of the Greens campaign? I've been quite impressed with Lorna Slater, who's a new face, really, the co-convener of the Scottish Greens, who did some of the debates in place of Patrick Harvey. Kez, what have you made of their campaign?
Yeah, she's been fab, and she looked like an absolute natural on the TV debates, like she'd been there forever. So I think that's a credit to them. I don't buy, I'm going to regret this, right, when the results come out on Saturday.
Prediction alert, here comes.
Yeah. I don't buy a massive rise in Green MSPs. Each of the last two Scottish Parliament elections had the Greens polling high, and on the day, people just didn't turn out for the Greens to the same extent as they'd hoped for, and their numbers were regularly half the size of what had been predicted 48 hours before in the last two Scottish Parliament elections. Why is that? Because actually, the vast majority of voters stick to their first party preference, and the SNP voters are particularly good at this because the SNP have always had a both votes SNP message. In fact, they're the only party who have always campaigned for both sides of the ballot paper. If you think that Labour used to focus relentlessly just on constituencies and thought that the list was something that was just a bit extra, a bit fluffy, and the Conservatives were naturally more focused on the list vote rather than winning comprehensively constituencies across the whole of the country. So I don't think the Greens are going to double their numbers. If they do, I then don't think that they'll go into formal coalition with the SNP. I don't think it is in Nicola Sturgeon's interest at all to go into formal coalition with the Greens. It's a risk because when you join a coalition, you create the opportunity for somebody to kind of flounce out at some point further down the line in a big traumatic fashion, and that carries a lot of reputational damage. But also the SNP like a minority government if they're in that position. They like being able to look one way for support on justice issues, another way for support on things like the National Care Service. That will suit their style, suit their agenda. The one thing where they worry about finding additional support is on the budget, of course. For many years, they looked to the Conservatives for support with their budgets. That's often forgotten. In recent times, it has been the Greens, and the Greens have got concessions as a consequence of that. I suspect those concessions will get bigger rather than the Greens going into government.
So I was talking to a Labour strategist, which is going to bring us on to the last party here. But I was talking to, actually, I forgot about the Lib Dems there. Rewind. We'll talk about the Lib Dems as well. I'm always forgetting about them. Sorry, Willie Rennie. I was talking to a Labour strategist about why the Greens seem to be polling higher, and their view was that the impact of Alex Salmond and Alaba had been to educate the SNP voter about the ability to strategically vote on this, on the list, but that Alaba were not being the beneficiary of this education program because they were all preferring the Greens. How does that theory sound to you, Chris, and what have you made of Alex Salmond's latest adventure in Scottish politics?
Well, it's a delicious irony, isn't it, that Salmond would educate independence voters in not voting SNP with the second vote, and then they vote for someone else. I've also got a slight hope that Alba get one seat and it's not Alex Salmond and it's just some person who's never been involved in politics and finds themselves on the back benches for the next 5 years.
That's very likely. I think that'll happen in the west of Scotland.
Really, really well. Yeah. You know, I think amusing for us all. The polls are, you know, what do they need? Sort of 5 to 6% to get a seat in each region. They seem to be polling between 2 and 4% at the moment. Perhaps they'll get one or two. Yeah. I don't think they're going to do any better than that. I think obviously the danger for Nicola Sturgeon is that Alex Salmond gets in and is just sitting there on the back benches, fomenting unrest, adding pressure to push Boris Johnson harder on an independence referendum or to look at other ways of starting to move towards independence. And as we know, she is cautious. She has worked very hard to woo the kind of indie curious and the soft nose, and with a degree of success, I think, you know, they're as close to independence as they've ever been. And I think a lot of that's down to the way she's managed the SNP since 2014. And what she doesn't need is Salmond coming in with his big boots on and his big macho swagger and starting to cause disruption.
But you've covered Alex Salmond. You must have been observing Alex Salmond for, 25 years anyway. You must have been pretty astonished by his trajectory.
No, not really, because I think the Alex Salmond's trajectory is entirely decided by what's best for Alex Salmond. He could easily have left politics after he stood down as First Minister. He could have gone away and got himself non-executive directorships and made some money and just been the grand old man of the nationalist movement. But he didn't, because it's not money that drives him, it's status. He's got to be in the front line and he's got to be the centre of attention. He did his fringe show so that he could be in the newspapers, be the centre of attention. He's done his RT show sponsored by the Kremlin, yeah, you know, again, because it puts him right in the spotlight. And now he's got his own party going again. But, you know, his popularity is, you know, I think he's the only politician in Scotland who's less popular than Boris Johnson.
In our latest poll from Servation, it was 9% of the population felt favourably towards him.
I'm going to have to go. I've got to go vote. Can you believe it? I've got to run. I'm sorry to bail out 40 minutes in, but the candidate is home, so I'm going to go and cast my vote.
Great. Okay. We'll say goodbye to Kez at this point.
Sorry.
Kez, thank you. Kez is off to vote, discharging her democratic right. Good luck with that. I'll not ask you how to vote. I suppose you deserve the privacy of the ballot box like everyone else.
It won't surprise anyone.
All right. Cheers, Kez. Okay.
Bye, Kez. Bye.
Chris, we'll mansplain a bit more politics for 5 minutes, and then I'll bring things to a close. You were just saying about Alex Salmond there if his motivation for setting up Alaba was status, it has not really worked out, because even I mean it's conceivably could get elected still because the numbers are very fine. But I think he has not been a prominent part of the conversation, and he has felt like a bit of a tired yesterday man throughout this, hasn't he?
There's a certain type of voter that looks at Alex Salmond and thinks, you know, he is the one for me. And I think we know those kind of people. We can see them because they're candidates for Alba, the councillors that have left the SNP to go for Alba. You know, there's a degree to which, you know, the irony that party is now opposing the SNP on the Gender Reform Act and claiming it's a party for women's rights, you know, make of that what you will. But there is, as we know, a not insubstantial backlash against the SNP's position on the Gender Reform Act within the SNP as well as outside the SNP. So
you asked Nicola Sturgeon about that, I'd noticed, in your interview.
Yeah, I did. And I didn't actually use it in the interview when I wrote it out, but I did tweet it. I tweeted her comments, and the response was extraordinary from, I guess, women, whether it's gender critical feminists or whatever. But, you know, the anger towards her took me aback. And the sense that she is not listening to women and has already made her mind up, has not handled the whole thing particularly well. But, you know, she's doubling down on it. There's no sign of any rowing back in her position on self-ID and things like that. So, again, in this election, I just wonder, many of the women I know are, you know, sort of educated professional women, are really angry about this, and it's almost the dominant reason for them voting in this election. So, again, just one of those threads that might be worth watching as the results come in.
My suspicion is that there's not been a public conversation about this issue appropriate to the level of interest it provokes amongst activists, and that is something that's likely to occur in the next parliamentary term at some point, I think.
I think so, and it's also not really something they're going to talk about during an election because it's so controversial and it makes so many people on both sides incredibly angry that, you know, it would be a big decision to say, right, let's go flat out on no to self-ID or yes to self-ID. It's, I think, you know, Sturgeon herself put back the bill until after the election precisely for that reason, because it's just too uncomfortable to talk about. But there's no doubt that Scotland needs a proper conversation about this, and voices need to be heard more than they have been already.
Great. To get Willie Rennie and the Lib Dems in, we'll just repeat the fact that he is great at picture opportunities and has really jazzed up newspaper pages with pictures on quiet days. So thank you very much for that, Willie Rennie. And I'm going to finish, Chris, with you and one of your other roles, which I mentioned, which is as the lead singer of the brilliant band Fat Cops. You're gigging soon. Plug it. What are you doing?
We are. Our new single comes out on May the 28th, called Plan of Attack, and we're on the label Last Night from Glasgow. And we've got more, an EP coming out later this year and an album next year. And we're going to be touring again, which is really exciting because I think, like other bands, we've really, really missed the chance to just get out and play live because it's the best fun in the world. So we're playing Brighton, London and Glasgow so far.
Does the Brighton gig coincide with the Labour Party conference?
It's September the 24th.
Yeah, sure it does. I think there might be some politicals in Brighton that weekend. So if I am there, I will come along.
I'll get a red t-shirt on then. But yeah, it's great fun. And, you know, we've been well reviewed, get decent audiences. We supported the Happy Mondays last year. More Fat Cops, please.
Well, best of luck with that and your other 17 jobs. And thank you. And thank you very much for joining us. And also thank you to Kezia Dugdale, who joined us before running off to vote. Thank you to Chris Finn for producing. Thanks, Paul Malik, for letting me keep his chair warm. And thank you for listening. For the Stushy, I've been David Clegg. Cheers.
The Stushy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stushy today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stushy or follow Stushy Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe, or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.